Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the White House's counterterrorism advisors briefing today, where the administration's position on the use of drones was clarified. A specialist in the law of war, Kenneth Anderson, joins us. He is a professor of law at American University and has studied the ethical and legal issues involved in drone and robotic warfare. Then we will examine the deteriorating political situation in the Ukraine, where the government is facing mounting pressure from European leaders who are expressing concern over the mistreatment of the jailed opposition leader Yulia Tymoshenko. A former U.S. ambassador to the Ukraine, Stephen Pfeiffer, joins us. We will discuss the mafia-like business oligarchs running Ukraine and the country's growing isolation. Then finally, we will speak with Sasha Meinrath, the director of the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, about CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Prevention Act the House just passed. We will discuss what is in the bill that the president has threatened to veto and what advocates for internet freedom and civil libertarians find alarming about it. And joining us now is Ken Anderson, a professor of international law at Washington College of Law at American University, where he specializes in international law, human rights, and the laws of war. Previously, he was founding director of the Human Rights Watch Arms Division and later general counsel to the Open Society Institute Soros Foundation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ken Anderson.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And today, the counterterrorism advisor to the White House, John Brennan, gave a fairly lengthy clarification of the White House's policies vis-a-vis drones at the Woodrow Wilson Center. This is an area that, of course, has elicited a great deal of passionate dissent, disgust, concern, ethical issues, notwithstanding, along with the vagueness of policy. How much was answered today, do you think?
Well, I think that this answered a lot, actually. I think that that if you look at this set against a whole series of speeches by senior officials, particularly the senior lawyers of the Obama administration over the course of the last 18 months, then I think that one sees an increasingly clear picture of how it is that the administration believes the U.S. government can lawfully and legitimately go about the process of targeted killing against Al-Qaeda using drones, but also using human teams. So I think actually that this is bringing clarification to this previously murky area.
So when John Brennan said that when he compared drones killing combatants in the war on terror, it's not obviously the same as conventional warfare, but he compared what's going on today with targeting Japanese and German commanders in World War II. Did that make sense to you?
I think it does in some ways and not in others. It's very crucial to the administration's view of this that this be seen, that all of this fighting against Al-Qaeda be seen in international law terms as part of an armed conflict. But in domestic law terms, the Obama administration has been very clear that it sees this as all under the authorization to use military force, the AUMF passed by Congress after 9/11. And so it wants to reach to the legal precedents that are closest to actual wartime uses of force, and the World War II cases are a pretty obvious case of that. I would say, adding to that, that there is another element of this, which is that these are strikes that are often being carried out by the CIA and are being carried out by the CIA in ways that participate in covert action and a whole different picture than one would associate with World War II and conventional warfare. So I think it's some of both in real life.
Well, didn't John Brennan make that distinction between what they call personality strikes and signature strikes?
Yes, although it is also true that signature strikes, which are against masses of enemy forces, perhaps low-level fighters, Taliban fighters in Pakistan, moving to cross the border, where that's really sort of like conventional warfare. That's going after a mass of enemy troops. But with this difference, that in this conflict, those strikes may well be being carried out by the CIA as well as by the military.
So what is the difference then between a soldier who fires an artillery round in the hope that they'll kill a bunch of enemy, or somebody that fires a mortar, and somebody that has a drone. It seems to me the fundamental difference is you actually see what you're about to kill.
You do see what you're about to kill, but I guess the most important thing to me from a sort of operational standpoint is you have far, far greater precision over the use of that weapon, whether to actually pull the trigger and strike. You've got somebody who's not sitting in the aircraft with this extremely limited loiter time over the target that's measured in seconds. These folks, when they're targeting the people they're targeting, they're able to follow them around. They're able to sort of track their movements for days and weeks on months on end. And so they actually have got the luxury of being able to choose the moment to strike in a way that isn't true most of the time of somebody who would be using, say, artillery or mortars or other kinds of equipment on the battlefield.
Again, I'm speaking with Ken Anderson, professor of international law at Washington College of Law at American University, where he specializes in international law, human rights, and the laws of war. So would this then be the difference between, say, manslaughter and first-degree murder? In other words, there's a premeditated aspect to it. Is that the difference here?
I don't think that I'd put it in criminal law terms, because this is war. This is armed conflict. These are people who can be lawfully targeted, and so the question is not so much whether it's a difference in premeditation. It's a question of where one sees the necessity to strike and how precisely one is able to carry out that strike so as to minimize the collateral damage around them. And the subtext of what I'm saying is that I think these drones are actually much, much more precise than the weapons that have preceded them, and that they, in fact, do allow for far fewer civilian casualties than would otherwise be the case. So just to be clear, I think these things are actually a very, very good weapon of war, because I think that they are, in fact, much more discriminating and much more precise.
But what explains then the revulsion that's there amongst the public, and not to mention amongst the Pakistanis, who seem to be where a lot of these drones are targeted?
Well, I certainly don't think that it's amongst the public in the United States. I think the United States public thinks this is all a pretty good idea, and actually quite solidly backs the administration on it. But in Pakistan, I think there's a number of factors. One is that, I don't think anybody is wild about foreign forces under any circumstances coming in and targeting folks in their country, even if it's the case that they would just as soon see them dead themselves. I think that part of that is just a very natural concern about sovereignty and concern about one's country and its space and its territory and the rest. And second, I think that to a fairly considerable degree, Pakistani public opinion is movable in directions that different interest groups in the country would like to see it pushed one way or the other. And I think that there simply is a lot of question about the extent to which there is actually civilian casualties in these strikes. And I think that in that regard, I just think that those controversies feed into people who, with very good reasons, are quite suspicious of their government in Pakistan and the information that it's passing out, to really be concerned about what the actual effects of these strikes are. But a lot of it, I just think, is the same concern that anybody else would have if somebody were coming in and striking in their country, even if on balance you thought it was a good idea.
Again, I'm speaking with Ken Anderson, professor of international law at Washington College of Law at American University, where he specializes in international law, human rights, and the laws of war. And we're talking about today's briefing by John Brennan, the counterterrorism official at the White House, who was speaking at the Woodrow Wilson Center today, where he spoke of the White House's policies on the use of drones. He actually used the word that they were wise. What do you make of that particular use of word?
What he's saying by that is that there are processes in place that in the first place are aimed at ensuring that the targeting is legal in under both U.S. domestic law as well as international law. And second, that beyond that, there's that beyond the bare legality of it, that there is some good reason to target that person, given the fact that under strict interpretations of the law, anybody who's associated themselves to these various forces could, in theory, become a target. And, of course, that's crazy. And so when he used the word wise, I think that he was referring to the idea that beyond the bare legality, there is actually very considered judgment going on among officials in the various national security agencies of different kinds, trying to make a considered evaluation whether striking at that individual is actually a good use of resources, a good use of force, a good strategic move. And I think he's trying to underscore that these are not mindless decisions. They're not just simply creating lists and then going after them. They're constantly evaluating the intelligence that goes on behind. And then the question is, does one believe any of that, right? In other words, the question for the American public is, do you actually believe that they're doing what it is that he's describing in that speech and that other officials have described in these speeches? And the problem with, so at that point, the question really becomes one of accountability to the public, because I would say that if the American public believes that that process is going as he says it's going, then I think by and large, the public, at least in this country, is pretty comfortable that that's what should be happening, because they do, you know, we do collectively want them striking against Al-Qaeda. We don't want people to sort of pack it in and say, I guess we're done with that. So at that point, the question really shifts from one of, do you think that's the right process for making these decisions, to do you believe them when they say that's what they're doing? And since they're not going to be in a position to invite you and me and the public in to see that process for, you know, sort of obvious security reasons, then that process by U.S. law is committed over to review and oversight by congressional leadership and by the intelligence committees that are tasked with that political oversight. And by and large, the word from, not by and large, as far as I know, 100% the word from those folks is that that process is an accurate description, that they're accurately describing what it is they're doing. There's been no word that I've heard from anybody on the intelligence oversight committees that there's anything other than that process going on.
So in terms of, when you, Ken Anderson, we were talking earlier about the two types of strikes with drones, personality strikes and signature strikes, being against, say, a group of Taliban that are gathered somewhere and are considered combatants. Personality strikes are people that are on a list of targets. What about an al-Awlaki, and the guy that was targeted and killed in Yemen along with his son, both of whom I believe were American citizens? Previously, that used to be any assassinations were supposed to be illegal under the CIA, but any major operation on the part of the CIA would require a finding that goes back to the use of torture or enhanced interrogation, as they prefer to call it. Are there findings involved with this, or is there a blanket finding?
There is no blanket finding in any of this. Anybody who's being specifically targeted under a personality strike has to be, there has to be a specific finding, and it has to be treated on an individual basis. Now, one of the things that I thought was quite significant in Brennan's speech today was, so far as I know, this is the first time that any U.S. senior U.S. official has come out and said on the record, in the case of targeting an American, there is some form of extra review given the fact that the person is an American citizen. And you know, he didn't reveal what that was, and he didn't reveal how that process takes place and how the oversight with Congress to ensure that American citizens receive the kind of process that the administration has said in other speeches that are required. None of that is revealed, but the very fact that he said for the first time that there is in a extra process, so to speak, in the consideration of American citizens, I think is significant, and that I think is new to this speech. So there are findings that have to be made. There's oversight that has to be done. The revisions to the covert action laws of the 1970s, dating back to, you know, the Watergate period and the church hearings and the rest, in the 70s have made it impossible for the president to claim that he did not know what his subordinates were doing. I mean, the whole point of those laws was to remove that possibility. And I think everybody's agreed that that has happened. So there is no such thing as plausible deniability for the president to say he didn't know who they were striking or what the conditions were. He has to sign off on these things. And so in that sense, that process, I think, is quite a robust one. Now, it's secret. And so the question is, do you believe the political leaders that are saying this is what they do, the congressional leaders who are saying, yeah, they are actually doing that? Does one believe Nancy Pelosi when she says the things that she's said, that the oversight process is actually very robust? So one can believe or not believe that, but the indications are that congressional leadership is briefed very, very deeply as to these things these days, in large part because the CIA does not want to be hung out to dry on this. They do not want to be in the position of anybody in Congress coming back to them and saying, you didn't inform us about what you were doing. So they've adopted a sort of, we'd rather hang together than hang separately. And so we are going to inform you of the stuff that we're doing, and I'd say that process is actually working, at least according to how the law makes it work.
So just in closing then, Ken Anderson, you were suggesting that drones are actually more discriminating. They're not an indiscriminate weapon, even though there has been a great deal of outrage about collateral civilian deaths. Obviously, though, there's a murky horizon ahead, surely. The possibility of, first of all, other countries developing drones, and then, you know, it's pretty one-sided warfare so far, with the U.S. dominating, and I guess the Israelis actually developed them, I think, first, dominating the battlefield, but inevitably that will change. But what about the civilian use? I mean, on the plus side, drones are being used to monitor the killing of civilians in Syria for some later, perhaps, trial against the Assad regime before the International Criminal Court. Presumably, they could be used in human rights to document human rights abuses. But what about their civilian use? So, what, you know, I mean, I can foresee, for example, a SWAT team using a drone.
Well, I think you are living in the epicenter of the rise of the drones. You live in California, where, to those of us who live out here in D.C., it sometimes appears that you are not allowed to live in California unless you have a hobby drone all your own. This field is just taking off in terms of hobby use, of civilian use of every kind, and that is the future of aviation technology to a very large extent. And so one of the things that people, as they think about this as a military technology, need to keep in mind that this technology is going to sweep aviation as a general field, and that by the time that transformation is done, the military applications of drones will be enormously important, but it'll actually be just one small part of how drones have transformed the rest of it. So look to see FedEx flying around its, you know, cargo planes as drones in the not-so-distant future. But also look for many things that are going to be really scary about drones from a civil liberties aspect. I've been defending their use in targeted killing as a precision weapon, as a way of being able to strike at a distance in the most precise way that we've ever seen, frankly, in the history of warfare. The combination of distance strikes with enormous precision is really something very new. I say that with regards to national security issues and fighting a war abroad. Within the United States, I think that there are many, many privacy issues and many civil liberties issues that are raised by the combination of drones plus increasingly better sensors and cameras and the ability to watch people on a 24-hour basis. And if you like, stream the entire thing to the web, combine it with emerging technologies and things like facial recognition technology, and you really do create the Big Brother ability, as China is clearly setting out to do, to be able to monitor people 24/7 and track their behavior through computer algorithms. And drones are a piece of that and a very scary part of a whole set of technologies together. So enthusiastic as I am about them as a national security tool for attacking enemies in faraway places, I think there are lots and lots of questions that are raised by them within the domestic sphere.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, Kenneth Anderson.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Anderson, who's a professor of international law at Washington College of Law at American University, where he specializes in international law, human rights, and laws of war. Previously, he was founding director of the Human Rights Watch Arms Division and later general counsel to the Open Society Institute Soros Foundation. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about political tensions in Ukraine, largely run by a mafia clique of business oligarchs. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, a former ambassador to the Ukraine. His career as a Foreign Service officer centered on Europe, the former Soviet Union, and arms control. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. At Brookings, he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And clearly, European leaders are sending signals to the government of the Ukraine that they're none too happy with the treatment of the jailed opposition leader, Yulia Tymoshenko. Several leaders are boycotting the European summit that's coming up in May the 11th, Austria, Czech Republic, Germany, Italy, and Slovenia. And a number of European leaders, including the head of the EU Commission, the President, Jose Manuel Barroso, he's going to be boycotting the Euro 2012 soccer tournament. That's a big deal. And I think Chancellor Merkel may also join in that boycott. What explains this growing isolation of this country and its leadership?
Well, the problem is that, and this goes back to really the beginning of 2011, when they brought up charges against former Prime Minister Tymoshenko. And it basically turns to a gas contract that she signed with Russia back in 2009. And you can certainly criticize the terms of the contract, but nobody in the West saw that as a criminal matter. And she was tried last summer. She was convicted and sent to prison for 7 years. And there has been increasing expressions of unhappiness both in Europe and Washington about her treatment.
Well, but the person who's charging her, her political rival, Viktor Yanukovych, he's always been considered something of a not a clone of Putin's, but certainly somebody that's more pro-Russian than she ever was, right?
Well, I'm not sure if I would say Yanukovych is pro-Russian. It's probably true that policies that he decided were in Ukraine's interest were a little bit closer to Russia than Tymoshenko's policies, but I'm not sure I'd say he's pro-Russian. But the issue here really is not so much about his foreign policy, but about Western concern about what's going on within Ukraine. And Tymoshenko, it's the case that gets the most attention, but there's probably a dozen other officials or former officials of the previous government who are facing similar charges or already in jail. You've seen a broad democratic regression during the time that Yanukovych has been president, and that's caused concern in the West.
So, but how much is there, should we look back at the history? Because it's never, since the end of the Soviet Union, there's always been political tension. It seems to be very personality driven. Yulia Tymoshenko, when she was in constant battles with her co-president, was she not, for a while there, that essentially led to the rise of this current president?
You know, that's exactly right. I mean, politics in Ukraine tend to be very much personality-driven. But what's happened to Tymoshenko is something new. I mean, Viktor Yanukovych, now the president, remember back in 2004, he was the one originally declared the winner of the runoff election, and it was seen as so fraudulent, it triggered the Orange Revolution, and then Viktor Yushchenko emerged as the president with Tymoshenko as his prime minister. And even then, there was no effort to bring Yanukovych to account for what was seen as a fairly massive fraud effort. The new thing here is that Yanukovych has moved directly against Tymoshenko, and it seems to be motivated really by personal animus against her.
And of course, in that mixture, I recall that Yushchenko, the former leader that she quarreled with, even though it's supposedly on the same side, he was given a massive dose of dioxin, which disfigured him. It looked like something right out of the KGB's Dirty Tricks. Not only was it hideously disfigured him, but what about the legacy of that element? When I mentioned early Russian connections, clearly Putin was alarmed by the Orange Revolution.
Yeah, I think even when Yushchenko was president, they did not seem to make a lot of progress in finding out who exactly was behind the poisoning. And But I think the broader issue, I mean, the unfortunate thing is that Yushchenko and Tymoshenko worked closely together in leading the Orange Revolution at the end of 2004. And then when they took power and they had huge support from the country really was thinking that this is a breakthrough, this can be a change. And unfortunately, because of their inability to work together, they wasted a huge opportunity. And you know, 6-7 years later now, there's a lot of disillusionment in Ukraine about the Orange Revolution.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative. He's a former ambassador to Ukraine. And what about, though, the fairly persistent reporting on the nature of this government being under the thrall of a kind of mafia-like business oligarchy, and that it's, you know, essentially thoroughly corrupt, to put it bluntly?
I mean, you've always had a series of major oligarchs in Ukraine, and corruption has always been a huge problem, unfortunately, in the country. One of the ironies, though, is that this government, the current government, which says that they are prosecuting Tymoshenko and others because they're going to draw the line and enforce rule of law, by most accounts I've heard from Western diplomats and from Western businesses, is corruption in Ukraine, if anything, in the last 2 years, has become much worse than it was. So there is a certain amount of problems that seem to be growing on the corruption side. And this, again, kind of feeds into the question, well, is the trial against Tymoshenko really about enforcing law and order, or is it more about using or manipulating the judicial system to go against political opponents? And most Western analysts have concluded it's very much that political manipulation to go against a political opponent.
And that, of course, has echoes of what's happened to Russia under Putin.
No, I think unfortunately, up until a couple of years ago, people looked at Ukraine and said, as the governments had not been successful in taking advantage of things like the Orange Revolution, but still as late as 2009, early 2010, they said the most democratic country in the post-Soviet space, with the exception of the Baltic states, is Ukraine. In 2006, Ukraine became the first post-Soviet state, other than one of the three Baltic countries, to get a Freedom House rating of fully free. In 2011, they became the first country in the post-Soviet space to lose that rating. And this, again, the irony is, Viktor Yanukovych was elected in early 2010 in an election that, by all accounts from both domestic and foreign observers, was the best election in Ukraine's history. And looking forward to this fall, when there will be parliamentary elections, people are beginning to ask, well, will there be, in fact, the sort of free and fair election that Mr. Yanukovych used to get elected? And there are worries that it may not be.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative. He's a former ambassador to Ukraine. And this European Football Association, the Euro Cup, the Euro tournament's coming up very soon. And I mentioned at the top of the interview that a number of European leaders are going to boycott, are already going to boycott the tournament, and possibility of Angela Merkel boycotting it as well. There have been bombings last Friday in one of the venues where the soccer tournament's to take place. And already the UEFA, that's the European Football Association's president, Michael Platini, is complaining about crooks and bandits hiking hotel rates across Ukraine. Is that trickle-down corruption?
Well, no, I think, you know, for Ukraine, it was a big deal several years ago when they were awarded the right with Poland to co-host the European Soccer Championships in 2012. It's a big deal. It's an opportunity for the country to showcase itself. But unfortunately, reports about hotel prices being jacked up, you know, corruption that some people have already encountered when they've gone there to do advanced visits, and then this Tymoshenko question is going to be a big cloud that can rain on that parade. So it's, I think, unfortunate because it's going to deny Ukraine the opportunity that it would have had to sort of demonstrate what is in many ways a very interesting country. There's a lot to see there and such. But it's all beginning to come under a cloud.
And what about these bombings? What's behind them, do you know?
They're still there. It's really strange. We saw there were three or four bombings in the city of Dnipropetrovsk on Friday. Nobody's claimed credit for it. There are lots of finger-pointing going back and forth, but at this point, no one's emerged with a good theory. So I think people are just waiting to see what emerges.
So there's a considerable ties, are there not, Stephen Pfeiffer, between the Ukraine and Canada? I believe there are about 1.2 or 1.5 million Canadians of Ukrainian extract. And
that's correct. Yes.
And the Canadians are watching the Yulia Tymoshenko case quite closely. They sent over two doctors to check on her. Pictures have appeared of her with bruises, etc. I mean, given her earlier behavior with not being able to work with her colleague and essentially, you know, not destroying the promise of Ukrainian democracy, but certainly setting it back, you know, one has to feel a little bit skeptical of her. You probably know her, right, or have met her?
She was deputy prime minister when I served there, so I do know her. She has her pluses and minuses. She's by no means a saint. But I think when you look at the case that was brought against her, it really does not hold water at all. I mean, she should not be in prison. And that's, I mean, it's the view of Canada. It's the view of the U.S. government. It's the view of most European Union states. And it's really when you look over the last year, really going back to the summer when the trial got underway, the outspoken criticism that's come from Western capitals has been striking. And it was in October when she was convicted. I mean, the fascinating thing was within 6 hours, you had condemnation coming from the European Union in Brussels, condemnation coming from most EU capitals, condemnation from Washington, and condemnation coming even from Moscow.
So, she's is this leadership tone deaf? I mean, why can't they just release her?
This is something I think it's a big question. Last September, there were signs that looked like they were moving in that direction. There was a very interesting suggestion that was made in the Ukrainian Parliament that they would look at the old criminal code, which in many parts dates back to the Soviet times, and that they might strike some of the provisions, including the provision that was the basis for her trial. And that seemed at the time in September of last year an elegant way out. They could just say, this is no longer a crime and release her. And the government, including President Yanukovych, generated certain expectations that they were going to move in that direction. And then in October, they did nothing, and she was convicted and sent off to prison for 7 years. So it's, you know, people are kind of scratching their heads and saying, what's going on here? And the politics are very hard to understand. If you go back to 2010 in the aftermath of the election, Tymoshenko's ratings were quite low. Her party had a fairly low rating. And what's happened in the last year, as she's been the focus of this bogus trial, lots of attention. Her ratings have gone up. Her party's ratings have gone up. And they've taken somebody who looked to be 2 years ago kind of fading from the political scene in Ukraine, and they've given her an incredible shot of new life.
Well, Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Glad to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative. He's a former ambassador to Ukraine. His career as a foreign service officer centered on Europe, the former Soviet Union, and arms control. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Councils. At Brookings, he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the new CISPA Act, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Prevention Act, that many consider an even greater horror than SOPA. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sasha Meinrath, who is the director of the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute and has been described as a community interest pioneer and an entrepreneurial visionary. He's the co-founder of Measurement Lab, a distribution platform for researchers around the world to deploy internet measurement tools, advance network research, and empower the public with useful information about their broadband connections. In addition, he coordinates the Open Source Wireless Coalition, a global partnership dedicated to the development of open source, low-cost wireless technologies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sasha Meinrath.
Thank you very much.
And the House last week passed the CISPA bill, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, and it's now before the Senate. There's some expectation on the part of the House that the president will sign it. He's issued an earlier veto threat. There's a Senate bill by Joseph Lieberman and Susan Collins that seems to have some legs. It put the jurisdiction side of Department of Homeland Security. What's your sense of this? Because there's a little bit of an alarm. There's been some alarm from the internet community, somewhat similar to the concerns about SOPA that happened previously. How bad is this CISPA?
Yeah, this bill is tremendously bad in that it enables, it empowers government and private industry to swap information in an extra-legal manner, to, in essence, invade the privacy of users of popular online services and applications. And that, for that reason alone, it's absolutely worth fighting against. The good news is that the White House has said that it is going to threaten or veto this bill, and that threat makes it more than likely that this bill is dead on arrival as soon as it gets to the Senate.
So what would the Senate bill then do? What could the Senate bill do to get the White House signature? What changes would be made? And what do you know about the Lieberman-Collins bill?
Right. So the key elements that have to be in any sort of bill are ones that put privacy safeguards and judicial review back into this space. Right now, what you in essence have are sort of the National Security Agency, the NSA, and law enforcement agencies being able to directly talk to private industry groups and then get access to, let's say, your Gmail account or your Facebook account without any court review of that process. And of course, in a society that abides by rule of law, this kind of extra legal maneuver is really anathema to our democracy. Now, if, and this is a big if, the bills that are being proposed put that kind of judicial review back in, there's a long chance that you might be able to get the White House back on board for this. But I very much doubt that. It would certainly need a lot of dramatic changes. And that would then put this bill into something called reconciliation, where the Senate version and the House version of the bills need to be brought to a small committee made up of members from both chambers, who would then have to agree on the final text of this bill.
Well, Sasha Meinrath, the House bill that sounds alarming from what you've told us was voted 248 to 168, with 42 Democrats joining 206 Republicans. How do they convince themselves that it was okay in the name of protecting the Internet and bolstering cybersecurity to put corporate America in bed with the government and share the information with the National Security Agency with no privacy rights to American citizens? How do they make that leap?
Yeah, I think most of them make the leap because they don't know what's in the bill or what its impacts are. I mean, people generally admitted this over the so-called PIPA debate, where they said, we don't know what's in this bill. We didn't realize the implications for what we were passing. And the reason why over SOPA PIPA you had everyone from human rights groups, public interest organizations, to high-tech firms all coming out against this bill was because we understand what the implications are. And the same problem exists for CISPA. And having read the text, I'm like, wow, this would really have incredibly bad implications for any kind of open service. It would have hugely detrimental implications for the online activities that we partake in every day. And because of that, because it seems that people don't understand the implications of the bills that they're passing, I think this adds to a series of decisions. Now, this isn't a one-off. It's a series of decisions that are being made by Congress that don't really effectively protect us online and certainly undermine our Fourth Amendment rights, and quite honestly, our First Amendment free speech rights online.
Again, I'm speaking with Sasha Meinrath, who is the director of the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, and he's also coordinates the Open Source Wireless Coalition, a global partnership dedicated to the development of open source, low-cost wireless technologies. So you're in the business of trying to make the Internet and information in general more accessible to more people at a lower cost, right?
Correct.
And this Online Piracy Act, CISPA, that's now been passed by the House, gone to the Senate, and the president may or may not veto it. It appears to do the opposite, which is to corporatize control over, in the name of security. Basically, it's an open season, isn't it? I mean, there's no restraints on the corporations and the national security agencies. Under this rubric, can't they investigate anything? I mean,
this bill allows, in essence, unilateral actions by law enforcement agencies without review, and in fact also includes provisions that gag people from being able to talk about when these issues happen. So I view it as like a good rule of thumb, is if this bill, you know, take the text of this bill and put it in the context of, say, an Iran or a Syria or North Korea or China, and if the bill text was the same, would it be a good idea or a bad idea for these countries to pass exactly the same language? And I think in that context, we would say, look, any bill that these governments pass that would allow them to circumvent any sort of transparency would gag people from even talking about the nefariousness when it does exist, that does this behind closed doors and directly, the purpose of this is to directly infringe upon the privacy rights of its citizenry. I think we would agree, on the left, the right, doesn't matter. We would agree this is a bad idea. And so in the United States, what we have is a bill that is pending that has really bad repercussions for our rights. And this is why you have a lot of folks, left and right, who have been fighting against this bill. I expect that, and I think one of the reasons why we've seen a rather unprecedented action by the White House to actually weigh in on a communications bill and threaten the veto. I think the reason for that is because people have begun to realize the implications of this are so detrimental. Not only do they undermine our rights locally, but they really undermine our foreign policy internationally, because the text of the bill is one that I'm certain that the rulers and authoritarian dictators of other countries would love to mirror in their own country.
Well, but somewhere in this, isn't there the intention, Sasha Meinrath, to protect the internet not just against sort of anarchists and hackers, but against the kind of cyber threats which appear to be coming from China?
Isn't absolutely. I'm not saying that the intentions are not good. I think we would all agree that the intention to protect innocents from the malfeasance of ne'er-do-wells is certainly well worth doing. The problem is that we have a technological reality that doesn't map onto what this legislation does. That the bad guys aren't sitting there on Gmail doing stuff in plain text. They're encrypting their email. They're doing things that are far more sophisticated than what this bill would enable law enforcement to counter. What this bill does is it sets up a surveillance regime not for the bad guys. It sets up a surveillance regime that casts a huge net over every John and Jane Doe in an attempt to, with that huge net, maybe get a couple of bad guys. But in the interim, what you do get is a tremendous number of false positives, a tremendous number of completely innocent people that get caught up in that surveillance net and have their lives destroyed because of it.
So do you think, Sasha Meinrath, that there's going to be, you mentioned earlier, similarities with this CISPA bill, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, and SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, that was heavily pushed here in Hollywood by the studios? Again, there is a real problem of piracy. Nobody should deny that reality. But it really alarmed a lot of people in terms of internet freedom. And eventually, there was quite a backlash with Wikipedia going dark for a day and Google with a black banner, and it really did turn things around. Everybody thought that because the former senator from Connecticut, Chris Dodd, was pushing it with his colleagues, it was a slam dunk. But then it became quite a surprise that so much of a backlash was generated. Is there going to be a similar backlash, do you think, now that this bill's passed the House in the Senate and somewhere on its way, presumably, to the president?
Yeah, so if this bill gains momentum in the Senate, I would expect at least as large a backlash. And I think it will be probably even angrier than what we'd seen before, because people feel that we already weighed in once. We already petitioned. 15 million people petitioned Congress in a 24-hour period. That may, in fact, be completely unprecedented. And yet here we are fighting the exact same battle that we did just a month or two ago. And I think people are fairly fed up. We already said once, this is a horrible idea. Go back to the drawing board, bring us something meaningfully different. And instead, CISPA is really sort of the same MO rewarmed. And it's just as bad the second time around as it was the first time around. So amongst my contacts, amongst the people that are in this space and have been for years, what we see is the same kind of people organizing and getting energized and getting ready to launch a second huge backlash against a bill that is perceived to be of the same ilk that SOPA and PIPA came out of.
So what explains why these bad bills are launched in the name of dealing with serious problems like piracy and protection of intellectual property and cybersecurity? I mean, who's writing them with this mendacious attempt? I can excuse the Congress because, one, they're corrupt. That's just a given. But two, they're not so bright. But, you know, who's pushing this stuff?
So I suspect that a lot of this came out of the back rooms of, you know, the RIAA and MPAA, the large copyright holder groups that for the movie industry and the movie and music industries. That's where SOPA and PIPA came out of. It's quite likely that their lobbyists helped draft a substantial portion of the actual language of that bill.
You mean they're trying to have another bite at the apple via this cybersecurity bill? Is that what you're arguing?
That's right. There's in some ways an alliance that's been made between law enforcement on the one hand and copyright holders on the other, that this kind of enormously invasive surveillance regime benefits both sectors. It helps copyright holders and it helps law enforcement. But unfortunately, it also undermines our fundamental human rights. It undermines our constitutionally guaranteed rights. And so this is why you have people on the left and the right fighting against these kinds of bills. The unfortunate reality is now SOPA People was sort of the forefront, the vanguard on that was the copyright industry. And CISPA is sort of the same bill, but the forefront on this one is law enforcement. But the alliance, the lobbying sector that is aligned to try to push these bills is one and the same for both.
So who's fighting against it? You say the White House has threatened a veto, and presumably the White House, in order to avoid a White House veto, there'll be some compromises made. Is there anything that's in the works that give you, Sasha Meinrath, any comfort that these civil liberties attacks that you feel are inherent in this bill are going to be, you know, mitigated and either eliminated or made acceptable to civil libertarians?
Yeah, I mean, my hope is that what you end up with is this bill never coming to vote, that people understand, senators understand that to do so would really invite a backlash by their constituencies on both the left and the right. That would be pretty substantial. I mean, all indicators are that people are really fired up and they're willing to battle on these issues. If it does come to a vote, what we would see again is sort of a SOPA PIPA-esque backlash, both against those that voted for it, and of course in an election year that looms large in a lot of people's decision making, but also pressuring of the White House directly to veto the bill as they have threatened to do.
Well, of course, John Boehner is accusing the White House of threatening to veto the bill, and not because the White House is interested in big government and that the House has this wonderful partnership between government and private corporations in this CISPA bill.
Yeah, that, to me, that's phenomenally bizarre, of a bill that would increase the government as being... then for not passing it, the White House is being accused of trying to be for big government. Clearly, this is a bill that, if passed, would require far more government invasiveness. And by vetoing it, you would lessen government intrusion into our lives. I'm not sure what's driving that sort of assessment. It doesn't map onto the actual reality of what's happening here.
Well, he says, Boehner says the White House are in a camp all by themselves. So what do you know, Sasha Meinrath, that's informed the White House to take this stand from day one? Because they threatened the House bill from day one, and of course the House went ahead and ignored them, and now they've got the bill before the Senate. You know, frankly, I haven't heard too much in the media, have you, about the kind of conversation we're having?
Yeah, this bill has been fairly quiet thus far in a lot of the media. That is not the case in the blogosphere, and certainly definitely not the case amongst civil liberties groups. And so, you know, in many ways, we're waiting to see what happens next. You know, we don't want to jump into the middle of a fray if we don't have to. We have limited time and limited resources. And so this bill is on its way to dying on its own, which it does appear to be. There's no reason to then kick it to the curb. On the other hand, if it does gain momentum, if it does look like it's going to pass, or even if it does pass, one would expect to see substantial outrage and the kind of SOPA PIPA-esque coverage that's sort of like this horse race and a big, you know, almost carnival-esque kind of coverage. But the reality is what's driving the concern over this bill really boils down very simply to wanting to ensure that whether you are online or offline, there's the same kind of judicial review and rule of law exists for your communications and your information. And really fundamentally what this breaks down to is there's a group of congressional members that want to take the same protections that we have in our offline life and eliminate them for our online life.
Well, just in closing then, Sasha Meinrath, I take it this all stems from 9/11, right? The post 9/11 thinking. That's the sort of mental environment, for the want of a better description, that has produced this bill.
Yes. And it comes out of the same sort of lack of due diligence, right? The Patriot Act passed instantaneously, a 900-page bill passed in the dead of the dark of night. Almost zero people would have had the ability to read it that fast if they were speed readers. And to me, that same kind of lack of due diligence, the same kind of lack of actual democratic deliberation, of discussion over these kinds of bills, is always going to be a danger to our civil rights. And so there are always going to be people that will take advantage of these opportunities. I'm certain that if they could, there's a number of lobbies that would push this through next time we have a major terrorist attack in the name of security. But in the end, what it does is it actually undermines our security. It does so because people then circumvent these kinds of surveillance mechanisms, and because, quite honestly, a lot of the bad guys have already moved on to technological solutions that this bill will do little to nothing to solve.
But it sounds like it's in the kind of milieu of the old Cold War joke of Mort Sahl's: the Russians arrest an American for spying, and the Americans retaliate by arresting an American for spying. The idea that Bin Laden is laughing, not that he's alive, but you know, the idea that every time we take our shoes off, he's laughing at the airport. In other words, we punish ourselves. I don't see anything in this bill that's going to stop the Chinese spy agencies from cyber attacks, is there?
No, I think that's exactly right. You've put your finger on it. This is a bill not focused on preventing what it claims to be focused on preventing. It's a bill focused on surveilling everyday Americans writ large and all of the social media and all of the private emails that we send every day. In essence, it comes from a mindset that thinks that if we just get more data into law enforcement's hands, that we can somehow stop the next terrorist attack.
Well, Sasha Meinrath, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Sasha Meinrath, who is the director of the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute. He's been described as a community internet pioneer and an entrepreneurial visionary. He's the co-founder of Measurement Lab, a distribution platform for researchers around the world to deploy internet measurement tools, advance network research, and empower the public with useful information about their broadband connections. In addition, he coordinates the Open Source Wireless Coalition, a global partnership dedicated to the development of open source, low-cost wireless technologies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.